Hey, I'm Mike Stopforth, and this is The One-Eyed Man, and this episode is going to be a little different. It's a live recording from the Cape Town launch of my new book, 52 Big Questions for Business Leaders. This is hosted by my good friend John Bradshaw at Exclusive Books in Cavendish. In the discussion, we explore the genesis of the book, we unpack some of the most provocative questions, we tackle what it means to lead in uncertainty, and we explore how asking better questions can unlock a new dimension of leadership, something I think is probably critical in the world today. If you'd like to get a copy of the book for yourself, please visit www.mikestopforth.com/books. Visit your nearest Exclusive Books where you can get a hard copy, or shop online at Takealot or Loot. And there is also an audiobook version on Audible, on Spotify, and Apple Books as well. The Kindle version is live too. I need to buy myself a copy of that one. A huge thank you to everyone who joined us in person on the night and made the event so memorable. I hope this recording captures some of that vibe, that energy, and gives you a few big questions of your own to wrestle with. Let's dive in.
Evening, everybody. Let's kick off. My name is John Bradshaw. Very excited to be hosting the book launch for 52 Big Questions for Business Leaders and Mike Stopforth. I think a bunch of you know him, but some of you don't. So I'm going to embarrass him by giving a full introduction to him. Yep, a full introduction, despite advice to the contrary. So Mike has been thinking about digital things since you guys were working out how to change the paper on your fax machine. Founded Cerebra in 2006, which was bought by WPP in 2013, kept leading that until 2018. And then your life seems to have exploded into 20 different lives. Since then, he founded Beyond Binary, a business and leadership transformation company, co-founded 48 Hours, a specialist social media crisis consultancy, loads of podcasts that you started, including the excellent One-Eyed Man, one of the hottest keynote speakers on the circuit, he tells me, founder of a jiu-jitsu studio, which I'm going to go to one day when I get brave. Just launched a digital marketing agency called Second Rodeo, brilliant name, which is pulling in loads of clients and keeping him very busy. And now published the book, this excellent book, which you're all here tonight, 52 Big Questions for Business Leaders. And so we're going to chat a little bit about that book tonight and get into it. And you're going to have a chance to ask some questions as well. So Mike, thank you so much for letting me be part of this. And I'm excited to get into the book. Welcome all of you.
Yeah.
How about a clap? Feels like we can have some applause. I'd love to kick off with just the genesis of this book. Where did it come from?
Thank you, John, for the question. John has done a wonderful job of introducing me, but done very little to introduce himself. John is a dear friend, is somebody that I met through the digital marketing industry, is an extremely accomplished marketer and communicator himself, and also runs the Nonfiction Book Club, which is a really cool...
Like and subscribe.
Immediately. John is doing some great work in that space, and you should definitely check it out. So the book started as a conversation with an entrepreneur friend of mine and of some of the guys that are here called Matthew Jacolo. And we were on a game drive together and talking about questions. And Matt is somebody who has refined the art of asking really deep questions, even in the most innocuous circumstances. And we were talking about the power of questions to unlock team capability. And we said, like enthusiastic entrepreneurs do, we should do something about that. And so we set up a Google Sheet, a shared Google Sheet, very quickly populated it with approximately 18 questions, and then did absolutely nothing for another 9 months. And so that idea nearly went to all of the places where the other unfinished manuscripts and ideas go, where also half of the socks go. After a while, realized that it was a project I really cared deeply about and had Matt's blessing to, take some more steps with it. And so, the book project was the result of that conversation.
So the 18 came very fast. One of the things I'm interested about, I noticed 52 questions, 52 weeks in the year.
Yes.
So was it a case of coming up with 18 fast and then really having to stretch to get to 52? Was it hard to get it down to 52?
Yeah, there's a classic case of this sounds like it's going to be easy. It's not. So the first questions that we put down were questions that both Matt and I had been asked before or asked regularly of our own teams or asked of each other. And that felt super natural and organic. And we wrote those down. And I was like, this is going to be the easiest project ever. And then that expanded to 33 questions that we gathered from various places. And then I hit that classic writer's block moment where I was like, there are not 52 questions in existence in the world, and I'm never going to be able to get this over the line. And then watched a really amazing video about the art of asking good questions, which unlocked a whole new line of thinking. And I write about that in the book a little bit as well, because I think I wanted to put questions down on paper, but I also wanted people to think about how to ask better questions. I think it's a very underrated skill set and a really powerful tool in business and in life. And so there we landed up with an excess of questions after that. We had a surplus. And so, and they cut it back down to 52 because it sounds better than 87 big questions for business leaders. The result was essentially a toolbox of questions that should last a team a year to navigate.
Well, we'll get into the questions, but you cut them down.
Yes.
So there must have been the 53rd one, the last one to go. What was the best question that didn't make the cut?
So there were really good questions that were on the list that were questions that we felt had people were already really familiar with or had seen or had read about or had used. So one of the questions that was very close to number 53, maybe not exactly number 53, was what would you attempt if you knew you couldn't fail? Which is a great question, but a question that many of you have probably heard or seen on a cool T-shirt on Temu or on a bumper sticker. So we were like, maybe that's not good enough to make the cut. So we wanted questions that were really good, but also reasonably original, or framed in a way that made more sense for people who were in business and wanted to solve intractable business problems. So that's how we got to the final 52.
In the book, you mentioned Gestalt. I'm not sure I'm saying that right. Gestalt language processing, which is applied in EO. I've always looked at EO from the outside as a really interesting place where founders go and ask good questions. I don't know if you're even allowed to talk about EO in a public forum, but can you talk a little bit about that GLP and how that's applied and how that's influenced your thinking on questions?
Yeah, I'd love to. And I suppose also maybe take a step back there, because the founding thesis for the book, the idea behind it was, as leaders, as business leaders or leaders in society or even leaders in families or in community projects, we are inclined to default to finding answers because they create a lot of certainty and surety. And sometimes we'll ask questions we probably already know the answer to because it reinforces thinking we already developed or it reinforces a plan we already had. I'm reminded of a project that I did with an insurance business in the UK, really interesting new technology-led insurance business. And their whole differentiator in the market is we're a data-led financial services provider. And we were doing a data literacy program with them. And one of the interview questions to their staff was, would you agree that the organization is a data-led organization? And one of the pieces of feedback was, absolutely, provided the data reinforces the decision that our leaders were already going to make, which yeah. I think speaks to a lot of how leaders, managers think about questions. This is, we often ask leading questions because it reinforces the outcome that we wanted in the first place. The reason why I'm saying that before, this is the longest answer to the shortest question ever, is... is that I think that there's extraordinary power in asking well-framed questions. And if you couple that with humility and a willingness to listen, I think it opens up possibility in blind spots, in the areas that we're not sure of. And in a world that feels, I think, increasingly uncertain and unpredictable, that's a really cool tool. So Gestalt language protocol, which is what you asked about in the first place, is a practice in EO and in EO forums, entrepreneurial forums, that suggests that the worst way to respond to a person's personal challenge or problem is with advice. Because advice carries with it almost always a sense of judgment, even if it's good advice, even if it's advice meant with the very best of intentions. And the second thing that advice does is it like imparts shared accountability. So if I give Neil advice on what he needs to do about the stroppy team member, if it doesn't work out, Neil can go, yeah, but you gave me that advice. And there was, yeah. So what EO encourages you to do is to share experiences. This is something that happened to me that might resonate with you, or to ask much better questions. And for a group of egotistical entrepreneurs who are pretty sure they know everything about the world all the time, it's really, really hard to do. But what I learned through that process, through 5 years of being part of a forum that really refined, that really held each other accountable to that, is that it's extraordinary what happens when you learn to ask great questions, especially of people that you trust and of teams that are designed to produce good work together. So I was like, I don't know of any space where this is something that's taught. We don't get taught to ask better questions.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, right, this is still the longest answer to the shortest question.
No, I think we're all enjoying it. If we need an intermission, I'll let you know.
Like throw a celery stick or something if I need to stop. But this is a little bit like cycling or running. When you start running for the first time as an adult, you assume that because you ran a lot as a kid, like you could run. And then you very quickly learn after your first incident of sciatica or fasciitis that like actually running is a skill and you need to learn how to run properly to reduce injuries. And it's a little bit like out of questions. We assume that because we've always asked questions, we know how to ask questions. But I think there's a very real and very kind of tangible skill set attached to asking great questions that can be learned and transferred. And I'm finished answering that question.
Well, that is fantastic.
Thanks.
The thing that really, really struck me as you were talking there is just that there are questions that are designed to confirm our beliefs. Like even that insurance one that you were talking about, the question of, would you agree that we're data-driven? Like the clue's in the question, buddy.
Yeah.
Right? Like, do you like working here? Yeah. Like nod when we clap. And there are other questions which are designed to uncover the truth, right? And there are other questions that are there to help somebody else find their way. And, you know, those different categories of questions can make it. There's another question, which I remember we had a lecturer at university who taught us this, which is when you don't know what to say in a meeting. And he said, guys, you've learned a lot over this four-year degree, but one day you're going to be sitting in a meeting and you're not going to know what to say. Just say, what about the tax? Right? It's always relevant, right? You don't have to answer it if you asked it, and that way you can give it up. There's a new version, does it scale? That's also another, you can
say that anyway. Did it scale?
And have you guys thought about how you could use generative AI to enhance this? That's also good. But one of the things I love about this book is you've put in a lot of thought into what makes a big question and what makes a good question. Can you unpack that a little bit for us?
Yeah. So I think there's a feeling about a big question. And then I think there's like some practical stuff. So I've had the privilege of being asked some incredible questions in my business journey and in personal life. And you know, it's a big question when it stops you in your tracks, when it gives you pause, right? When you're like, oh, like, I don't really know how to answer that. I saw somebody saying the other day that we should stop asking each other, how are you? Or how are you doing? Or what's up? Or what do you do for a living? Because those are kind of programmed and we almost answer them automatically. Like they were like, what we should ask each other is, what are you interested in? Because you'll be like, jeepers, I actually have to answer that intentionally. I have to think about what I'm interested in right now. And so the first thing is that there's a feeling to a bigger question that it forces you to stop and think. You have to engage that part of your brain that Daniel Kahneman says forces you to think slower. But there's like characteristics of a big question. I think the first thing is that you want a big question to be open-ended. So you could ask a very fancy question that's still closed-ended, like the one earlier on, right? Like, do you feel that generative AI tools will be a critical part of your company's innovation journey over the next 5 years?
Yes.
Yeah. So it sounds like a big question, but it's actually a closed question.
Yeah.
And it almost always is loaded with some intention or some intended outcome. So if a question can be answered yes or no, I don't think the person who's asking it has put enough thought into the question. So that's the first thing. Like, if it doesn't initiate some sort of an emotional response, if it doesn't make me go, oh, actually, like, that does apply to me on a personal level. If I can remove myself from it, if I can dissociate and make it, like, emotionally over there, it's very easy to answer and very easy to kind of observe as an idea. The third thing that I think is really interesting is to put tension into the question. And one of the best ways to do that is with time frames, right?
Yes.
So to introduce the challenge of time, one of my favorite questions in the book is a thought experiment that says, how would you structure your day? I'm gonna completely paraphrase from what's actually in the book, but how would you structure your day if you only had one hour to do your work? So it creates a tension, it creates a kind of personal prompt, and it forces you to think about limitations and the best use of your time. That was another question that was on 54, 56 is what's the best use of your time? And I'm like, I can't ask that twice. And then the last thing from a deep question perspective is...
It's got to be a challenge.
Got to be a challenge.
It's got to stretch you.
I read the book. I found it in the book.
Thank you very much. So I appreciate that. I should check my notes.
Excellent, excellent. So the questions in the book are structured in a bunch of categories. There's branding and positioning, leadership and vision, people and culture, purpose and productivity, self-reflection, personal growth, strategy and innovation. So it doesn't feel like it's a collectively exhaustive set of categories. There's not what about the tax isn't even in there. So in terms of those categories, how did you get drawn to those categories, or how did those end up being the categories?
So there's the PR answer here, and then there's the honest answer. So we mapped out the 52 questions, and we wrote the most of the book before. And this is not the proverbial we. There were people involved, so just I'm not being weird when I say we. And we talked about that just now. And I think that almost as a complete manuscript to Tracy, who published it, and Tracy said, "I don't like this at all." Because this is just like very factual. It's very cold. It's just questions. It says nothing about, and there's no personality in it. And she was correct. And that was quite deliberate because I didn't want it to be personal. I wanted anybody to be able to pick up any question and use it as a tool in conversation. But she said, if it's going to be a book, there needs to be some anecdotal value to it. So what we did was we spliced the questions up. We grouped them into similar topics. And as you said, that it's not exhaustive, but we noticed that there were definitely some common threads, a little bit of overlap here and there. And then what I did was I framed each section with my own experiences in strategy and innovation or people and culture, which is a section that Craig doesn't know yet but contributed to heavily.
He doesn't look nervous at all.
All good things. Leadership and vision, branding and positioning, which happened to alphabetically be the first section, but is a great way for me to intro the book because it's my book.
It's alphabetical. Okay. All right.
So yeah, so that's how that came about. And like that was the part I actually enjoyed the most, because writing about our experiences in business and some of the lessons I'd learned through those lenses was actually really, really cool. And some sections were easier to write about than others. Those of you who know my attitude for financial astuteness, the section on purpose and productivity was hard. But the rest of it was
really in the sequel, cool. The section on cash flow is going to be great.
Yeah, it's absent.
Yeah,
so there's no C. For example, you asked, where's the section on like operations and stuff? And I was like, the version of this book that could have been written was like, there's going to be leadership, HR, operations, strat. And there was a draft that looked like that. And I was like, I died of boredom trying to write about those things. And so we framed it more through narrative, which worked up well.
That's great. You mentioned we. You want to talk a little bit about the people who were involved in bringing the project to life?
Yeah. So Matt was obviously really important to the early part of the project. I wouldn't have come up with the idea on my own. And he really helped frame the early thinking around like what makes a great question. And then Belinda Mountain, who is an incredible writer and published author in her own right, really helped me think through what it might look like as a book project, and also just how to frame it for publishers, because I've only been through that journey once before, and we don't talk about that book. And then I realized when I was getting close to the deadline that there was no ways I was going to finish it on my own. And so Jackie Nash helped me project manage it. We did the entire thing remotely together. Jackie's based in Kenton-on-Sea, And her job was really just to harass me to get sections of the book over the line. And she did an amazing job helping that happen. And then, of course, there's Tracy and her editing team and the publishing team that did it, Janine, the publicist who helped organize this. But yeah, without Belinda and Jackie, I don't think it would have gotten anywhere near finished. It would have gone to die with socks and the other manuscripts that haunt him on a daily basis. Yeah.
Fantastic. Takes a village. How would you suggest people use this book?
Probably not if people sit and read it cover to cover, because I don't know if it's that useful as that kind of a read. In fact, you'll probably die of boredom doing that.
No, it's a great read.
It's a great read, and you should definitely go cover to cover.
He works in marketing.
No, but it's designed to be a tool. It really is designed. So like, I think that it's most useful if you are either, like, even potentially personally as a meditation tool. So picking up a question and going, actually, I want to sit and think about that at length, but like really wrestle with it, really sort of grapple with it. I think it's incredibly powerful as a facilitation or coaching tool. I think it's really powerful for teams. So this is how I hope people will use it, is that it sits on a boardroom table and it's used as an icebreaker in a meeting, or is used as a strategic facilitation tool. Like, we have to unpack this topic. So we've got a problem around people and culture. Let's flip to that section and go, why would good people leave our business? It's a really interesting question. And then we can dig deeply into asking questions around that. And then, sorry, there's another thing I didn't mention, I think is a good characteristic of a great question or a big question, is that it forces you to ask other questions after. And so why would good people leave our business is what would we define as good people in our business? And you can start from there and then kind of cascade down into other versions of the question.
Yeah. One of the things I really found in reading this book was, it's not just the questions. Actually, the questions are said in context of the sections.
Yeah.
And the sections have really good intros to kind of give you a feel for the space. And then each of the questions has a lot of background, a lot of richness in how you think about it, how you approach it. So I wanted to give you a little bit of a sense for that. And to force Mike to dance a little bit on the spot for us, we are going to pick one of the 52 questions. So Ayla, if you want to come up here, we are going to pick some questions from here. And then based on that question, we're going to go to the question in the book. And then we're going to ask you about that. Let's go. What do we have? Number 32, one of my favorites. What am I most afraid of? I'm not going to ask you to answer these questions. Why is that such a helpful question, do you think, for business leaders?
I think that the vast majority, and this is something that I've come to learn probably more in the marketing space than most other spaces, is that the vast majority of strategic decisions for organizations that find themselves in really saturated and highly competitive markets are generally fueled by one of two emotions. The most powerful one is fear of loss, fear of falling behind, fear of making mistakes, fear of being found out. And the other emotion is jealousy. So a lot of the questions that our clients would ask us in the marketing space is we would love to set up this kind of campaign or pursue having this social media profile and adjust.
A flash mob,
or can you make this viral? And generally that was because a competitor had done it. So not necessarily because it was something that they were leading with or taking initiative around. So yeah, I think identifying what we're afraid of collectively as an organization is a really great way to weed out that as a platform for strategic thinking, and rather look at value creation or collaboration or opportunity or optimism as foundational pillars rather.
Yeah, wider lens questions. All right, Ayla, give us another great question. 25, you like the odd ones. Which unspoken values are shaping my business? What negative values have you seen in businesses that you've felt, oh, we just need to nip it in the bud, either in the businesses you've worked with or the businesses you've run? What are like the values that you, now that you founding a new business, are very quick to catch and shut down if you see them emerging?
I am going to answer your question just in a very roundabout way. So I think this is my favorite topic in business and in leadership. The idea of values, explicit and implicit values, and I write about this a lot in the book because I think it is it's deeply misunderstood. I think we talk a lot about values as a sort of like a trophy that leaders wear, and we get together and have offsites, and we get a facilitator to help us come up with really great values. And then we build a PowerPoint deck that have those values mapped out in detail. And then we get a person to make vinyl stickers and put that on a Perspex shield in the reception area. We are customer centric, moved by integrity, whatever else. And the person that has the closest relationship with those values is often the person who cleans them, rather than the people who they are meant to represent. And I think that, you know, we used to talk in marketing a lot about like how all of your reputational risk as a brand exists somewhere between what you promise your customers and what you deliver as an organization. And the bigger the gap between the two, the harder it is to manage risk. The same is true for leaders in organizations who purport to exude a set of values, but in practice behave in a completely or diametrically different way. And I think that every organization has values. You can't put a group of people together and coordinate them without there being some sorts of values that guide them. What we get wrong is instead of trying to understand, codify, and then nurture the good ones, we try and like retrofit values that sound good or that we think our employees will want to rally behind. So the example that I love, the example I use in the book is those of you who have watched Wolf of Wall Street, the movie, player, and many of you will have, I use Stratton Oakmont's, Jordan Belfort's business, as an example of a business with outstanding values. And that sounds really counterintuitive because if you watch the film, you understand why that would be jarring to hear. But I think why they're interesting values is not because they are morally defensible, but because he was extraordinarily consistent in deciding what was important for his organization, what he wanted to gravitate people to, and then consistently communicating those over and over again with heaps of cocaine. And that was obviously very effective, not sustainable, not morally defensible, but consistent, clear, concise, and well-communicated value. It's,
yeah.
And I use that example because it is jarring and it does kind of create a bit of a sort of dissonance. But I think that's what values are. They are a recognition of what is implicit in your organization, codifying them in a way that makes sense to people, and then communicating them consistently over time. Leadership is communication and consistency, like combined. And if you can connect that with truth in a way that people really resonate with, then I think you've solved the values equation. So what are some of the worst values that I've discovered or that I'm kind of very, I have an aversion to? I think one of the values that I think is characterized by a lot of businesses, and especially services businesses and businesses that we run and have been in, is this idea of making people the primary focal points of conversation and debate and often discourse and gossip. I love that saying that says, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but big minds discuss ideas, small minds discuss people, something like that. But this idea, like if an organization's primary fuel for conversation is gossip, talking about other people in the organization, yeah, that's a value that I think is outrageously destructive. Yeah.
Yeah, and there's that idea of the problem is out there so that we can deal with it, as opposed to here, then we can't deal with it. But you have recently founded Second Rodeo. Is there a unusual value that you're really trying to nurture and bring to the front there?
In the two months,
it's been a busy few months.
I don't know yet. So one of the things that I'm really wary of or aware of early on with our journey is not trying to retrofit the way that previous businesses that I've been involved in worked on this business, recognizing that it's a new time, it's a new organization, it's a new group of people, and that values are only half my contribution. It's also what emerges out of that community and that group, and trying to recognize that, understand that, and then not force a way that worked before, because the recipe might have worked before, but it's very different ingredients and a very different outcome now. So yeah, trying to observe that and be open to it, and also open to the behaviors and values that maybe are not natural for me, but are very natural for this group of people, is like an important part of it. And I think it'll change.
We'll ask you again when we get the sequel, right? For next. All right. Ella, let's do one more. Let's do one more here. The question is, what's something extraordinary about my business and its people that I really appreciate as much as I should? So maybe if I apply that, you've worked in a bunch of businesses, you've been involved in a bunch of things. What's something that only over the passage of time did you realize was something really special and extraordinary about that business?
So when you're running a business and you've gotten used to a rhythm of maintenance and a routine, I think it's easy to forget how hard it is to create something new from scratch. I certainly took that for granted. I got pretty high on my own ability to recreate value, and I'm pretty sure I'll be able to kind of replicate this. And it turns out it's really, really hard to do so. Really hard to do so. So one of the things that I failed to recognize was really valuable about the business that I was in was not necessarily its intrinsic value from a balance sheet perspective. It was the extraordinary community that we had and the validation on a very selfish level, but also identity that I had rooted in that community. And that's difficult to replicate. So that's why I'm hiring lots of people fast to try and force
them. Of the village.
Forced community. I mean, what could possibly go wrong? But
brilliant. I don't know if there's anyone with a pressing question that they would like publicly. Throw up your hand. Mr. Smith, if that's your real name.
What do you say success for this book? Like in a year's time, what would you go like? Green book out there is like really great piece of yourself out into the world. So what do you think will make you proud of this or those else?
My secret ambition, my goal, kind of professional goal, is that if Second Rodeo is successful and in some way, shape or form replicates the journey in Cerebra, then I hope that it creates the freedom for me to pursue some of the things that I'm really, really passionate about. And what I'm really passionate about is facilitation. Like, it's not a particularly sexy thing. It's not necessarily an idea that scales. I don't know how I'll use generative AI in it, but I love working with groups of people to solve really tough problems. And one of the ways I love to do that is with really good questions. And so this book, I hope, creates a foundation of credibility to be able to do that more in the future. And so that's my big ambition. If it opens up space for me to do more of that kind of work with companies and people and groups that I care about, that'll be a win. Although there is a secret motivation. And that's we specifically designed it so that you could hypothetically have 52 big questions for teenagers. So trying to replicate the success of that series, but yeah, good. I think that would be success for me if it opens up a new chapter in career exploration.
But that makes so much sense to me, because you read this book, it really does feel like it's an attempt to bring facilitation at scale.
Yeah.
Each one of these questions is a question that you could unpack with great value with your team, that you'd want to do with the facility. Okay, another question. Throw your hand up fast. Oh, there we go.
What if your employees were running your business? So what would they change?
So I think it's an interesting question, because it's tempting to think about what the answers might be without asking it properly. So if you imagine a management team setting and perhaps a few senior employees getting together to ask that question, the manager might imagine a version of that conversation that is it would be really about well-being and health. How do we create the kind of organization that people arrive at and leave better? All of those sorts of things. But actually, the real answers, if you have rigorous and tough debates around that question, might be it would be quite shit. It might be that, because maybe we haven't thought about accountability or risk or the complexities that exist at a certain level of autonomy in a business that aren't necessarily everybody's problem to worry about. So there's a version of a lot of these questions that's really PR friendly and really team friendly. I'm hoping that it's something that can fuel debate and that can result in more questions down the line. But I think there's in a lot of the organizations that I've worked in, there's a massive disconnect between what management or executive teams want to achieve and the degree to which their constituents are aligned to that. And so I talk about this idea of alignment along with the book, how do you fuel alignment? How do you foster that? How do you communicate alignment? But in a way that's authentic, because I think you can create wild expectations and big, hairy, audacious goals and all sorts of KPIs that inspire people but aren't necessarily attainable, and that alienates teams. So I think alignment for me is really about kind of getting back to that shared values thing, which again is getting back to authenticity and. So I hope some of that answers the question, and I trust you will enjoy the rest of the pamphlet.
All right, one more question there. Yeah.
What is your best advice for leaders hearing themselves to be better enough to answer questions that are designed to change.
So one of the things I talk about in the book, and actually this is probably a good clue for conversation in general, like if you're having a really good conversation with someone, but I talk about like monitoring the emotional response that you have to a question, because your instinctive emotional response to a question is probably a clue to how important it is for you to ask it. So if you immediately feel kind of, well, defensive, or that's not something I want to explore, or that's something that initiates an angry response or whatever it might be, that's a really good question to ruminate on, because there's something in the way that it's asked or the way that it's phrased or the way that the person is asking it that is triggering a really interesting response in yourself. So I guess one of the skills that you'd want to foster as a leader, and certainly something I have tried to work on and continue to work on, is not just having an emotional response to being challenged or with somebody asking you a question that's triggering in some way, but observing that response, sitting back and going, why might I be having that response in that way? And then kind of responding after that. But I suppose having the time and space to sit back and monitor emotional responses is tough, especially when you're under pressure or when you're in a heated moment with your team or with your colleague. I think the way that we feel about these things are clues to their importance. And that's one of the ways that we can prepare, is by being more aware of that response.
Brilliant. I think we're going to call it there. Michael, thank you so much for writing this book. It really does feel like a gift. Thank you for doing the hard work to put it into the universe. I'm sure all of you are going to buy the book. Do force Mike to sign it, even if he doesn't want to. Right. Enjoy. It's been a real privilege to be a little part of this journey with you, Michael. It's a brilliant book, and we look forward to seeing loads more. Thank you very much. So cheers.
Thank you, Dilip, for everything and for sitting out. Yeah, it's been really awesome. So thank you very much. And buy lots of books from Exclusive.
Yeah.
You've been listening to the One-Eyed Man podcast. I'm Mike Stopforth, an entrepreneur, writer, and public speaker, deeply curious about discovering better ways to lead and better ways to live in an increasingly complex world. I find the best source of these ideas is the experience and wisdom of interesting people who are taking unconventional approaches to solving the world's most compelling problems. If you'd like to hear from someone I haven't yet spoken to, visit mikestopforth.com, click on the podcast link, and send through your suggestions. A big thanks to the Solid Gold Podcast Studios in Johannesburg, South Africa, for making this production possible. And remember, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man / person is king.
You've been listening to another episode from the Solid Gold Podcast Studios.